In talks about reducing the nation's exploding health care costs, the R word, rationing, strikes fear into the hearts of both patients and doctors. Why, many people ask, shouldn't the richest country in the world spend whatever is necessary to protect and preserve its citizens' health? This is the philosophy under which our health care system operates, and it promises to bankrupt us without necessarily improving our health. In more instances than many people realize, doing more medically can be worse than doing less. Too often, costly, overly aggressive medical care causes more pain and suffering than if nothing had been done at all. That's from a New York Times article by Jane Brody called Trimming a Bloated Healthcare System. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Why is healthcare reform such a controversial and difficult issue in this country? Why is our healthcare so expensive? And what might we learn from healthcare systems in other countries? Is it a good thing that we have so many specialists? How will the Supreme Court decision about the Affordable Care Act affect American healthcare? Joining us to discuss these and other questions about the challenges and opportunities of providing great health care is Dr. Jeffrey Grossman, professor of medicine at the UW-Madison and senior associate dean for clinical affairs at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Well, we could keep this hour very simple if I just said it's a mess, isn't it? And you could hold forth probably for at least an hour on that. But this doesn't seem to have been quite so much on everybody's minds 40, 50 years ago. What's changed?
What's changed is really the financial situation, the economics of healthcare, which have grown extraordinarily over the last 40 or 50 years and are now reaching the point where it's clear that the system is not sustainable at its current rate of growth.
When you say the financial system, you're talking about within the healthcare industry or economics in general?
You're talking about the healthcare industry. There used to be enough money to pay for the things that we thought we needed to take care of people. And there simply isn't anymore.
Is that because we've gotten fancier? We have all these, you know, computer-generated tests and, you know, just really fancy technological advances.
So I think if you look for a single answer to why healthcare is more expensive, you won't find it. And there are really a multiplicity of answers. There's a huge amount of overexpenditure, unnecessary expenditure for healthcare in this country, and you can divide it into several different categories. Some estimates are that somewhere between $800 billion and $1 trillion of our healthcare costs, which is about 30% of our healthcare costs, are really unnecessary and could get taken out of the system if we did the right things. So what are some of those things? For one thing, about a quarter of that waste is spent on what most of us would consider unnecessary service. That is, as you pointed out in the introduction, Emily, things that are not really beneficial to people's health. We have great expectations in this country for healthcare. There is, as you pointed out, a sensibility that more is better. And there is also a predominance of specialists in this country. All those things drive this system of doing unnecessary things. So, for example, there is a very clear correlation between the number of specialists you have in a community, the number of hospital beds you have in a community, and how much utilization there is of the services that those specialists provide and how full those hospital beds are. So this is called supply-dependent utilization. The more doctors you have in a certain specialty, the more kinds of work that's going to happen in that specialty.
You seem to be saying that if it's available, people will use it whether they need it or not?
Well, that's true, and it's a little hard to define whether that need is driven by the consumer or by the healthcare provider. Probably a combination of both.
And when you say healthcare provider, does that
talking
also
about? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, does that also include the insurance industry?
The insurance industry, I think, is sort of a bystander on this one. That is, the insurance industry is permissive in many ways, or has been permissive in many ways, in allowing this overutilization to occur. I think to its credit, the insurance industry is now taking a much closer look at unnecessary care and trying to rein some of that in.
But isn't kind of the basic problem here that medicine is being run as a business? That anytime you have something that is sort of a basic human right like medical care, and it's mixed with for-profit, you know, making money, you are going to get unnecessary tests ordered. Because if I come to see you in the clinic and you spend time talking to me about my family history and listening to me, that's not going to generate much money. But if you order a CT and an EKG and a bunch of other alphabet soup kinds of tests, it'll bring in a lot of money for the hospital, right?
Well, so what you're talking about is another one of those drivers of healthcare costs. It's not the only driver, but it clearly is. So we have what people would call in our system perverse incentives. We have payments for things that don't necessarily improve health. We have more and more technology that has only a marginal effect in improving health, or sometimes has a negative effect in improving health, but does create revenue and therefore profits. So the answer to your question is yes, our financial system in healthcare is perverse, and many of us feel it needs to be changed. That becomes, in turn, both a political and a cultural issue. We are the only country in the economically developed countries that doesn't consider it a right, if you will, to health care for all. That is, we do not have universal access to health care. The Affordable Care Act has now taken us a long way towards resolving that problem, but that is a matter of great political debate in this country, as you well know.
Talk us through the latest on that act and what it provides, and maybe even a little bit about what would be the 31st or 32nd effort of the Republicans to repeal it.
The act was originally put forth as a health care reform bill. I think in its essence, it really is a health insurance reform bill. That is what it does. In its most important aspect, I think, is provide coverage for those 50 million or so patients, those 50 million or so citizens who heretofore did not have access to medical care. And that, from my perspective, is far and away the most important part of this bill. And it takes us towards really a different culture and a different ethic of recognizing the right of everybody to have access to health care. So that's a terribly important piece of it, and I think many people in healthcare would have been really distraught had that part of the bill been overturned. There are some pieces in the bill that get to healthcare reform, and when I talk about healthcare reform, I mean changing the way we provide health care. And that comes back to the question of incentives and perverse incentives and how we pay ourselves for the work we do. So embedded in the bill, just as a kind of start, it's not these are not definitive solutions to the health care crisis, but as a start are a number of pieces that allow for incentives across the country, particularly in the care of Medicare patients and Medicaid patients, to make care all those things that we want to make it. And that includes safer care. It includes more timely care. It includes effective care, efficient care, patient-centered care, and as we talked about a moment ago, equitable care, that is access for all. So those things There are lots of little experiments or opportunities for experiments embedded in the bill, which I think are very important in starting creating a kind of inflection point for changing our thinking about how healthcare is delivered.
So why would anybody oppose that? What are the objections?
You're asking the wrong person.
Devil's advocate here.
Well, there's a lot of money being poured into opposing it, right?
There is, and there are clear objections. I have to say that I believe that part of this is simply our current political system, and there seems to be no ability to have rapprochement on any issue between the Democrats and Republicans. But beyond that, it actually is a bit hard to understand why, for me at least, why there is such opposition. I think much of it is embedded in the political philosophy of people standing on their own feet, and that is the conservative political philosophy of people standing on their own feet and not necessarily seeing health care as an entitlement.
And so what would they cite as the cost? Let's say I can stand on my own feet. This is going to provide for 50 million Americans who presumably or demonstrably cannot pay, legitimately pay,
right,
for their expenses. What does it cost me if I'm able to support myself medically?
So I think that what you've asked is sort of the crucial question in this whole healthcare dilemma, or a crucial question in this whole healthcare dilemma. By adding 50 million people to the population for whom we feel responsible, implicitly we're going to increase costs. And so if we want to add those 50 million people and not increase costs, then clearly we have to change something in the system. And those changes come to cutting back the costs for delivering high-quality care. So I think that there's a political, social, ethical, cultural, whatever you might call it, concern about providing, if you will, free care to people, and also a concern that it will add cost to the system. I think those of us who are on the other side of this, that is, think that this is a virtuous and a worthy bill, although just to start, see this as an opportunity, a catalyst to really bring the cost, the efficiency issues to the forefront and start working on them in earnest.
And we're not perhaps talking about the fact that so many people show up in ERs if they don't have insurance, and then those costs are astronomical.
That's right. There are arguments, very good arguments to be made, that the way our current healthcare system functions in the care of the uninsured patients is very, very dysfunctional, that it actually increases costs for those patients. They tend to avoid preventive care. They tend to avoid primary care and experience only episodic care during crises, and then are lost to follow-up typically. That's a much, much more expensive way to take care of people in the long run.
One phrase that comes up in the Affordable Care Act is about pre-existing conditions. I remember reading a recent article about a father who donated a kidney to his daughter and then was denied health insurance for himself because he had a pre-existing condition of lacking a kidney. You know, it's just those sorts of crazy situations. But the pre-existing condition, can you explain how that works with the new?
Well, what you're getting at is really how insurance works. And the way insurance works, health insurance and really all kinds of insurance, is that a company has to take in enough premium to cover the costs of health care. And so there's always a balance, and we call that consideration underwriting. There's always a balance between taking on the risk that a patient, a particular patient or a population of patient presents, and how much the insurance company takes in for that population of patients. Insurance companies don't do well if they take in less money than they have to pay out. And so there is always a tendency to try to have the healthiest patients be part of your insurance company because they cost less. And that's a sort of natural tendency. It's built into how the business works. And it, of course, doesn't do a bit of good in addressing the real problems of the most chronically ill, the people who have multiple illnesses, as many, many of the elderly in our population do these days. And so, again, there's a sort of perversity here. From the business model sense, insurance companies do what makes good sense. From a social, cultural, ethical point of view, they're in a financial situation that is not really helpful to those who are most in need.
If you look to find models elsewhere outside the United States, where do you see kind of some ideas of how things could be done differently?
Well, there really are ideas all over the place, and we have to recognize that our health care costs are higher per capita than any other developed country in the world. Now, you might say that that's okay because we have the best health care in the world. But in fact, we don't. And we have to think about that in the right ways to avoid getting into arguments about that. So for a person who is acutely ill, let's say I walked out of Vilas Hall and got hit by a bus, I would want to be right here. I wouldn't want to be in any other country. If I were to walk out and have a heart attack, I'd want to be right here. I wouldn't want to be in any other country. We do supremely well at caring for acute, catastrophic kind of illnesses in this country. And that's because of our technology. It's because of our exceptional cadre of physician specialists in this country. It's because of our wonderful hospital system that is geared up to do these kinds of things. That is a piece of healthcare that's very important to all of us if we or somebody in our family is acutely ill. But if you look at this on a population basis, which is a terribly important way to look at it, it is not the bulk of what healthcare or health is about. And that is about taking care of people throughout their lives, dealing with what are typically chronic diseases that last for years, if not decades, and that require a highly functional system. And what do I mean by a highly functional system? Again, one that is very efficient in what it does, one that's effective in what it does, one that's safe in what it does, one that gives good access, that is timely access, and one that's patient-centered, one that really concentrates on the needs of its patients.
Do we have a sense that America is healthier than it was before all of this became an issue? I mean, we hear about, for example, you know, diabetes on the rise and all these other, I'll call them, well, some environmental and some behavioral-related diseases that are on the rise?
Well, in fact, we don't have that sense, and that's most unfortunate. So if you look at what's happened, for instance, to mortality and the average age at which people die in this country, and you look at us over the span of the last 20, 30 years, almost every other developed country that we look at has made a larger percentage increase in its lifespan than the United States has. So we started off in the middle of the pack, and we're still kind of in the middle of the pack. Many other countries have moved on a much steeper and better curve. So medically, we may be doing better. It's very hard, as you just alluded to separate out medical care from the other determinants of health. And those environmental determinants, along with genetic determinants, are extraordinarily important. We're just on the cusp now of understanding some of those genetic determinants and being able to deal with them. And that's going to be a tremendous breakthrough in the care of patients in the population when we really understand the genetic components of health and disease. That will really give us the chance to prevent and attack disease at a molecular level that so far we're largely unable to do. But then we have the environmental components, which are just as important. And the epidemic of obesity, the epidemic of diabetes has nothing to do with an ineffective medical care system. It has everything to do with our economy and our culture. And those are things that have to be attacked on a very broad basis.
And it just puts a greater strain on the healthcare system.
It puts an enormous strain on the healthcare system and certainly increases the cost of care.
Is it partly because we don't cover enough people for preventive care? We wait until something goes horribly wrong?
Well, that's part of the question. You know, we talked about the $800 billion or so that people think could be saved. Probably of that $800 billion, there's $50, $60 billion that could be cost avoidance in preventive care. So preventive care is terribly important, but it is not the only answer. And once you have a patient with established diabetes, preventive care doesn't help anymore. And the determinants of that obesity and diabetes really exist outside the doctor's office, outside the healthcare system.
We'll look further at the prospects for your health and our healthcare system when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Dr. Jeffrey Grossman, and we are talking about providing great health care challenges and opportunities. Let's back up and get a definition of what, from your point of view, would constitute great health care.
It's a great question, Emily. And there are several, I think, wonderful guidelines we have now to kind of as goals to set our compass, to sort of have a true north for what a great healthcare system would be, or what a great health system would be. And so one of them are the set of goals that we talked about, which came out of the Institute of Medicine report in 2001 that was entitled The Quality Chasm. And that set out the six goals and for healthcare. And it may be worth going through them one by one just to talk a little bit more about them. One is safety. And that Institute of Medicine report followed about 3 years on the heels of the report called from the same Institute of Medicine called To Err Is Human, that pointed out that safety was a major issue in our healthcare system, and that there were indeed things that were embedded in our healthcare system that were implicitly unsafe, and that we had a very vulnerable population, in particular in our hospitals, who had no idea that while they were in hospital being cared for, they actually were at risk for things that were implicit in our hospital, in our healthcare system. So safety is terribly important and what has to be one of our major goals. People should be entitled to be safe when they're getting healthcare. Timeliness is a second thing, and that is the issue of access to healthcare when it's needed. For some people, as we've talked about, there has been no sense of timeliness at all because there simply has not been access. For others who are in the healthcare system who are entitled to healthcare, timeliness can still be a problem. One of the big issues with timeliness that we've faced over the last few years is a shortage of primary care physicians and access to primary care. In the Massachusetts situation that is so much talked about now in the political arena, while universal health care became possible through legislation, they simply did not have enough primary care doctors to take care of all the patients who became eligible for health care. So simply making health care available through insurance doesn't create timely access necessarily. We have to talk about effective care, and we touched on this a little earlier. Care that does not deliver improved health is not care that we want to deliver. And that is sometimes a very easy thing to think about, sometimes a very difficult thing to think about. So some of the things that have been in the news lately point out how difficult this can be. Mammography as a preventive care measure, when do we do it? Prostate screening, prostate surgery. Those are the kinds of things where we want to deliver effective care, and we're not so sure what's effective and what's not. We want to be efficient in our systems, and efficiency is something that is terribly, terribly lacking in our systems. If you think about the way that we deliver healthcare, it's a model that is much the same as it was 100 years ago. That is, it's based on a person coming into a doctor's office or a hospital, but let's stick with the doctor's office for the moment, sitting in a waiting room for an interminable amount of time.
Old magazines.
Old magazines, bad magazines. Then getting put into essentially another waiting room, which is the exam room, where you sit again, though this time probably without any clothes on or and just a gown, and even a smaller selection of magazines. Then you have a very brief encounter typically with a physician, may or may not get your questions answered. Often, we know, leave with some confusion about what's been said, what's been done, and what the follow-up is. That's a terribly old system. It is based on a time when we didn't have information technology, when we had very little we could do for patients. It just is very, very inefficient. If you think about the use of technology in other areas, when's the last time you went to a bank for a transaction? When's the last time you went to a travel agent to book an airline ticket? When's the last time you went to a library to check out a book? All those things have changed dramatically, much to our benefit. And we have to bring some of those changes to the delivery of healthcare. I am not suggesting that personal contact is not important. It's terribly important. But we should use it in an appropriate way and not in ways that just waste time. We talked about equality or equity in getting healthcare. And that has to be another goal of our system. And finally, patient-centeredness. And this is now become an almost hackneyed phrase, and everybody has a patient-centered platform in their healthcare system. It's really pretty simple. It's about doing what we're supposed to be doing in the first place, which is looking after the best interests with our patients of our patients. I think the place where this is most striking to me as a failure of our system, and again, a failure that's embedded in political issues, is in end-of-life care. End-of-life care is a, I think, extraordinarily misunderstood problem in this country. It is obviously ubiquitous and has become politicized beyond the point which we can even safely talk about it. At this point, that's a terrible thing. We are very often, again, for political and legal reasons, misconstruing, ignoring, not directly dealing with patients' wishes at the end of life.
We could maybe take the end at the beginning, then, if we were to go through those various components of what you're describing as an ideal healthcare system. How can I put this in a way that won't sound glib, but isn't the end of life longer than it used to be?
Yeah, there's a whole different view of the end of life. The prevailing view used to be that you would sort of do everything you could for a patient, and then when it appeared that it was hopeless, you would immediately kind of cut off care and there'd be a quick downhill ride from there. I think we've greatly expanded our view of the end of life, and those of us who are in some form of advanced age and suffer from chronic disease are experiencing a gradual decline and a gradual movement towards the end of life. So we've in many ways replaced end of life care with what we more broadly would call palliative care, which is improving the quality of life throughout the experience of illness.
I would think most doctors would feel split in two in some ways, that they have the patient's best interest in mind. They want all those things you've been talking about in terms of great health care. But then they're up against a system where they have to work with HMOs, Medicare, pharmaceuticals, the cost of different things. And they've got some patients where you're supposed to save and not spend, others where you're supposed to spend extra. And it's a kind of crazy situation. I would think most physicians would be pulling their hair out.
Well, you'll notice. I think you're right. It's a very frustrating position because there are diametrically opposed incentives and disincentives in what is an increasingly regulated and therefore complicated situation. So let me say that I think that physicians, nurses, those people who provide health care are still committed to doing the best thing for their patients. And you've alluded to that, Emily. And I think that's still true. When I teach our second year medical students, which I do every year, and our fourth year students, which I do every year, they don't strike me as any different than the students that I taught 30 years ago. That is, they have gone into medicine, into healthcare for very virtuous reasons. They're committed. They have great values and senses of social responsibility. In many ways, they are more productive as citizens than medical students were 20 or 30 years ago. So what happens? They get trapped in a system that is very powerful and to which, if they're going to adapt, they have to change how they work. So let's get down to some details of how this works. There are many communities and within communities, many patients who doctors see for whom they get paid on a fee-for-service basis. What does that mean? It means that every time they see a patient or do something, a procedure for a patient, there's a click and that they get reimbursed for that click. And that is the driving force, the economic driving force for those patients. There's another set of patients, and in this community we have a lot of these patients who belong to health maintenance organizations. For those patients, the form of payment is entirely different. And for those patients, we get a fixed sum of money at the beginning of every year to provide all the health care needs of those patients. For those patients, in fact, every time we do something, it costs us money to do it. And we're really in a totally opposite situation as in the fee-for-service world. If you're in the worst of all worlds, you're in a community where this might be split 50-50. And so we don't treat patients based upon whether they're in the fee-for-service world or in the HMO world. We treat them all the same. That is, our doctors don't look at what kind of insurance they have and how they're going to get reimbursed for their care. But as a system, it leaves us really very confused about what our goals should be. We know what they are, and they've been defined by these six goals from the Institute of Medicine. But taking a financial system that doesn't necessarily reward those goals, trying to work in that financial system and yet achieve those goals is very confusing and very difficult. And that's, again, why some of the things that we're starting to see in the Affordable Care Act are so important, because they are changing this model of care, or attempting to change the model of care, so that fee-for-service that is just doing volumes of things is less important, and turning to outcomes as a basis for payment. That is, needing to show that what you have done for a patient actually improves their health, is high quality, and at a lower cost. And when you look at quality and cost, you can combine those two and talk about value. And that's where we're headed these days, towards a system that appreciates and reimburses for value, for higher quality and lower cost. If we can then tie that to how we get reimbursed for providing health care, we can then put physicians and nurses and all healthcare workers in a much more sensible, rational, understandable kind of system, so that they know what the required outputs are, that is, high quality, low cost, and they can work towards those ends.
Now, if I'm a wealthy person with a heart condition, do I have to stand in line with the bankrupt person with a heart condition? Does it level the playing field that much from the standpoint of the user?
I think that you'll find that in almost all of Western society, no matter how equitable the healthcare system is, wealthy people always have an advantage in finding their own level of health care as their means allow. So I think the answer to that is generally no. What's much more important is that large, large population, the non-wealthy population, who will now have a chance for access. So it's the 99 versus 1% issue.
Is there a country, you know, this game came up when Medicare was first proposed and has from time to time since. But is there a country that we can say, well, this has, you know, the shining light on top of the hill. It's got medical care that's safe, timely, that improves health, patient-centered, equitable, all of that?
There is no perfect example. And we look at Canada, we look at England, we look at Germany, we look at France, all of which have elements of things that we might consider incorporating and that teach us lessons about what may be necessary and what may not be necessary for an efficient system. But they're not – many of them are not directly transferable to – what happens in this country
Sure.
because of our culture. There was an interesting piece in The Economist a few years ago which suggested that one of the problems with American healthcare was that we simply had a fear of dying that was not existent in Europe and that we believed that immortality was an entitlement for us. and it was written tongue-in-cheek, but I think the cultural imperatives that people feel about healthcare are terribly important in driving these costs. Those, as I understand it, not having lived in those countries, those kinds of sensibilities about immortality are non-existent, and people are much more accepting of the natural trajectory of life.
Sort of heroic efforts to save the patient who is on a one-way street toward the end of life tend to be disproportionately expensive compared to other treatments earlier on?
They are, and we need to be careful about talking about that because it obviously makes good sense that at the end of life, healthcare costs are going to go up because people are more needy. So it would not really it doesn't make sense to say that healthcare costs don't rise at the end of life. At least from my point of view, it doesn't. But we have to, on the other hand, control those costs. And I think much of that could be embedded in simply listening to our patients and hearing what they want for the end of life. You know, if you ask people where they want to die, nobody wants to die in a hospital. And yet increasing numbers of people do die in the hospital. So there's a disconnection between what people say they want and what I believe they want. And what happens to them as a part of their natural history connected to the medical system.
Is another difference between America and other countries besides this sort of sense of immortality and sort of doing all that we can and so on, is another difference the fact that our CEOs make so much more, that there's such a disproportionate gap between rich and poor that we accept that kind of disparity in our healthcare system where we have people who are poor, people who are disenfranchised in many ways, who are out of the system, that we accept a division that other countries don't accept?
Yeah, I think that's a cultural question that I can't answer, again, not having lived in another country or being an expert in those kind of sociologic issues. What is clear to me from reading about healthcare in other countries is that there is a different set of sensibilities on the part of the populace about what their expectations can and should be.
We're going to talk more about great healthcare, challenges and opportunities when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Jeffrey Grossman. We're looking at the challenges of health care in this country. And we have heard that the ideal health care system would provide safe service, timely service. It would improve health. It would be efficient. It would also be patient-centered, and it would be equitable. And if we're talking about efficiency, let's just pull one of those out and look at the temptation then to run a medical office more like a factory. Is that something that's actually going consideration?
Well, I think talking about running a medical office like a factory is probably off-putting both to patients and to the people who provide care. But embedded in your question is a very important observation, and that is related to efficiency. We have not done the sorts of things, we have not been reflective, nor have we used all the tools that are available these days to look at how we actually run our operations. And we are increasingly aware of those tools. These are the tools that industrial engineers do use in factories. And to the extent those principles allow us to re-examine how we work, there's the notion of not working harder but working smarter. They're very, very important to us. And so every time we build a new facility now, for instance, and we're doing we're in the midst of this process right now, we are re-envisioning our operations and thinking about the patient experience from the time they come to the door of that facility or even well before they get to the door in preparation for coming to the door and what their experience will be. So we're looking not only at the experience of the people who provide care, but we're looking at the experience of the patient also. One of the typical ways to apply these principles now is through what's called lean thinking. This was the process that originated in the Toyota factories in Japan, but it is very, very applicable to healthcare and all sorts of other kinds of operational endeavors. And it's really about expunging waste from the system, of taking all unnecessary things out of the system and doing those things that are important, that are essential, that provide good output. So we've had wonderful relationships here with our industrial engineering colleagues, and we have many projects underway that speak to changing operations in this way. In particular, and the one that we're most proud about and pleased with, is a complete reengineering of our primary care system. So we are taking the patient experience and the physician and nurse experience, looking at all aspects of it, turning it upside down, inside out, and trying to re-engineer it so that it is an experience that is all those things we talked about, safe, efficient, effective, timely, et cetera.
Can you give me a concrete example of how that would work if I come into with a problem. And how do I not feel like a car on an assembly line?
Yeah, and I want to – let me speak to that second question first, because this is really, while it could be thought about as dehumanizing medicine, it's really about humanizing medicine. It's about making the things that can be taken out of the operations invisible to patients, so that time spent with a nurse, time spent with a physician, is really useful time, the most useful time to the patient. So let me give you some examples of how some of this kind of thing works. Rather than coming into an office and having to register when you get to the office and answer that same 100 questions you've asked before, why not get that done before you come to the office? Once you have an established problem, how we care for that problem is terribly important. So let's say a patient comes in with a new diagnosis of high blood pressure. What's the best way to deal with that? It's a very common problem. What's our goal? Our goal is to get that person's blood pressure under control in as short a time span as possible, to do it in a way that's most convenient for that patient, to do it in a way that creates the fewest side effects for that patient, to do it in a way that's the least costly for that patient and the system. So the normal paradigm might be for the doctor to start the patient on some medications and have them come back in a week or two to have their blood pressure checked. And then they might come back and need a little tweaking of their medication and have another appointment set up for 2 weeks hence. It turns out that there's a lot of unnecessary steps there. So you definitely need to see a physician probably at the beginning of that course and have some thinking, important thinking done and some discussion about what the best medications are, what those side effects may be, what the trade-offs are for those side effects, et cetera. Once that's done, then there's wonderful evidence that a nurse talking to you at home, you with your blood pressure monitor at home, can do a much more effective job of getting your blood pressure under control in a timely way than having to have you come in for repeated doctor visits. So what does that do? It's more convenient for you. It gets you to the point you want to get to or you need to get to sooner. It decreases the cost of care because we don't have you seeing a physician. We don't have the overhead for that physician's office if this care is delivered at home. Those are the kinds of things that we need to rethink. Implicit in this whole piece is this notion that we want everybody in our healthcare system working at the highest level of competence. We have not used medical assistants and nurses and therapists to their full advantage in our system. It's been a top-heavy system. It's been too doctor-dependent. There are many things that other healthcare providers besides doctors can provide just as effectively and at lower cost and with greater patient satisfaction.
And what if I come in with clinical depression?
That's a great question because what we know is that a huge, huge portal into the medical system is because of mental health problems. Depression in particular, as you've implied, is a very, very big problem. Not only is it a standalone problem, but we also find that it is associated with many diseases. And conversely, many diseases, especially chronic diseases, have depression associated with them. So mental health services are tremendously important, and often in our payment system, not well attended to, which is to say that even the best insurance systems often have limitations on payment for mental health services. And I think that there has been a huge underestimation of the effect of mental health and in particular depression on the health of our population, not just on individual health, but if we look at our population as a whole, mental health is a huge driver of population health needs, and we clearly need to do a better job. So one of the things we're talking about now, for instance, and this comes back to the re-engineering, is instead of having a group of mental health clinicians who are remote from all the other pieces of the healthcare system, to actually have mental health services embedded directly in the primary care system so that it becomes part of this the medical home, if you will, the holistic approach to patient care.
We hear a lot when it comes to that subject of insurance, which none of us can get away from. We hear a lot about a single-payer system. What are the virtues of that and how would it work?
Well, the virtues of a single-payer system, which would essentially be a, if it was government-run, would be a Medicare-like system, are that it has homogeneity. It has a certain set of standards that apply to everybody. Interestingly, despite the typical critiques we hear about government programs, the administrative expenses for Medicare are actually considerably less than the commercial insurance industry. And so there would be an implicit cost savings there. And we would have the kind of regulation that would make certain that there was proper underwriting, there was proper accessibility for patients. Now, having said all that, you don't have to have universal health care. I think many people would agree you don't need to have universal health care. You can have good access, good insurance, as they do in several Western European countries, and yet have private insurers. The distinction between the system in those countries and in our country is that those private insurers are highly regulated. That's the difference. And that's also for certain segments of our population, for certain segments of our society, and particularly the insurance industry, not something that they want to have happen. But if you have a highly regulated system, then you can impose the right standards. You can make sure that people are being covered in the way they should, that underwriting takes place the way it should, that everybody has access, pre-existing conditions don't eliminate you, et cetera. So you don't have to have a single-payer system in order to be successful at this, but you do have to have regulation.
Greater regulation. Is the Affordable Health Care Act then really compelling everybody to have insurance or be penalized?
Well, the answer is in general, yes. So there is this mandate. And as you know, that was the point of greatest contention in the Supreme Court decision. There is a mandate. It's important to say why this mandate is so important. You cannot have, and this is I think, a fundamental fact and is very undermining of the arguments against mandates, constitutional issues notwithstanding. You cannot have a cost-effective insurance system without everybody participating. You need the healthy people as well as those who are ill participating in the system in order to make it affordable.
Friends from Australia that we're visiting, that are doctors there, said that everyone has a basic coverage and then rich people pay for extra frills.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of model is that?
Well, I think, you know, rich people can pay for all kinds of extra things, and I think that is simply a inherent factor in Western mm-hmm. society. I think if the basic package is the right basic package, that's a reasonably good place to start.
And we have just started with Dr. Jeffrey Grossman. We could go on for a long time because this phenomenon of healthcare in the United States changes daily, or it seems to. Thanks for joining us and scratching the surface this hour. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure entirely.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for our next hour of University of the Air.